This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Our conversation tonight is with Adam Johnson, whose captivating novel, The Orphan Master's Son, is set in the clouded reality of North Korea. Born in South Dakota and raised in Arizona, Adam Johnson earned a BA in journalism from Arizona State University, an MFA in the writing program at McNeese State University, and a PhD in English from Florida State University in the year 2000. He is currently a San Francisco writer and associate professor in creative writing at Stanford University, where he founded the Stanford Graphic Novel Project and was named one of the most influential and imaginative college professors by Playboy magazine. Did you get a center spread?
My top honor.
Aha. He's the author of this novel, The Orphan Master's Son, which Michiko Kukutani, writing in the New York Times, has called a daring and remarkable novel, a novel that not only opens a frightening window on the mysterious kingdom of North Korea, but one that also excavates the very meaning of love and sacrifice. Johnson's interest in the topic arose from his sensitivity to the language of propaganda, wherever it may occur. His numerous awards and scholarships include the 2010 California Book Award, a Whiting Writers Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and a Stegner Fellowship. He was named Debut Writer of the Year by Amazon.com in 2002, and the next year was selected for the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers series. Adam, it is so delightful to welcome you to Word by Word.
Gil, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
95% of this book occurs in a country that actively prohibits outsiders from discovering and revealing its secrets. So how did you do the research? I noticed in the back that you had people who traveled with you to North Korea.
That's right.
What else did you do?
I became fascinated with North Korea just as a reader. You know, when I write fiction, I usually read nonfiction. I find it very stimulating in a way that doesn't compete with what I'm trying to do. And I just started reading about North Korea. I remember reading The Aquariums of Pyongyang by Kang Chul-hwan. And I guess, like many Americans, I didn't really understand the history of the peninsula. I didn't understand the degree to which they'd been subjugated by the Japanese from 1910 to, you know, the end of the war 35 years later. I didn't know about the gulag system and that it was alive and functioning, and it was the worst prison system functioning in the world today. And so as I just kept reading books and articles, I became obsessed with the topic.
Mm-hmm. So you said yourself woke up one morning and said, I'm going to write about North Korea and have my protagonist spend his life there.
Well, it's an interesting question. When does a writer really understand that he or she's writing a book? I use fiction to process things that I think about or that are going on in my life. I often write sketches or do voice pieces. And so I started playing around with propaganda. The idea that there would be a single state-approved storytelling mode became fascinating to me, quite funny, though also quite serious. And the material just grew and grew. And I don't know if there was a day that I realized, oh, no, I'm going to mess up the next 5 years of my life writing on this book. But it occurred.
One of the things, you open the book with a radio, I guess you would call, mm-hmm. propaganda announcement, which talks about what, you know, the great leader is doing that day, you know, whether mm-hmm. he's opening a flower show or investigating the troops for something, and what other members of the government are doing. And then also sort of a, I guess you would call it a ongoing love story that happens between one of the leaders of the mines, the director of the mines, and the famous actress who have all – star of all the North Korean movies.
That's right. Well, you know, to speak to this notion of propaganda, you know, as I studied the country, I came to understand that in the early 70s, Kim Il-sung wired the nation with what's essentially cable radio. He was afraid that these – domestic transmissions would be intercepted or possibly jammed. And so in every house and every factory floor, it used to be in all the public plazas, there would be loudspeakers. And under the guise of a civil defense system, that was the excuse for doing it. And there's no way to refuse this propaganda that comes into your house all morning and all evening. If you're caught tampering with a loudspeaker, it's an offense that could get you sent to a gulag along with your family. Mm-hmm. And so the more I read propaganda, and it's so mind-numbingly painful to be force-fed lies that are of no value to you. It's boring, repetitive, and it's time-wasting. And I tried to conceive what it would be like to live under the weight of that every day. And I thought to try to capture North Korea, I had to get that dimension in the book. But how to do it without boring my reader?
Right.
I do find the propaganda quite absurd and funny as well. So almost all the propaganda in my loudspeaker voice sections, and they're small for the readers, contains humorous things that I really found.
That you found when you were visiting or in research?
That I found in reading right. propaganda.
Right.
The central newspaper, the Workers' Party newspaper, is called the Rodong Sinmun, and it's put out by the KCNA every morning. The Japanese are obsessed with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so they –
How turn, so? How are they obsessed?
Well, it's an interesting relationship. They – you know, Imperial Japan colonized – you know, the peninsula, and the North perhaps got the worst treatment in the deal. But the Japanese conscripted 5.4 million slave laborers from Korea to run the factories. And so in
they conscripted women to do other things.
Oh, the comfort women, the killings, the starvation. They exported all the rice from Korea and left the Koreans to eat millet for 35 years. And even when, you know, we dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those were industrial towns where the Mitsubishi headquarters were. Those factories were filled with Korean slave laborers, not Japanese. So there are lots of ethnic Koreans still in Japan, and I think it's Japan working out its troubled relationship with what it had done by fixating on the strangeness of the North.
Mm-hmm. And there's certainly enough strange things there to fixate on.
There's no end of absurdities. And actually one of my challenges in trying to find the human dimension of a place that's very difficult to ascertain those qualities was to get past the absurdities, to try to leave a lot of that out, as tempting as it is for a writer to bring those real life things in, and to mitigate the darkness. I tried to keep the real life research and the results it yielded as to the true perilous nature of the gulag system there. I had to tone it down a great deal because it just – while absurdity undercut the humanity of my characters, the malevolence of how people are treated there weighed them down.
Yeah, you mentioned, for example, that there was this the propaganda that's transmitted every single day, and the fear still that the Americans are going to invade it, the Japanese are going to invade
that's
it any
right.
second.
That's right.
And you have to keep listening. At least the parents of one of the characters insist they listen to it, because they want to be aware if there's
right.
a warning coming.
You know, if you think about from the North Korean perspective, for about a millennium they've been a pawn of China, Mongolia, or Japan, a possession that's been traded through wars that were fought on their territory.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't known self-determination or independence for long stretches at all. Then you think of the way they were occupied for the – first part of the last century, then World War II came, then partition between the Soviets and the Americans, then the Korean War, then the rise of a totalitarian regime. It's a pretty dark century for the people of that nation. But also from their perspective, they have had 60 years without a foreign invader ruling them, and in their perspective, that's a pretty great success. And in the Korean War, the Americans bombed Korea mercilessly. We had a fleet of planes designed to fight two global theaters on a planetary scale, and we unleashed it all on a very relatively small place. We bombed Pyongyang in the middle of the war. To the degree that only three buildings were left standing. And those memories are seared and they are real. And the regime, of course, uses that fear and perpetuates it as if it's a current reality to keep control of the people.
And they do that in so many subtle ways. For instance, we open in an orphanage, mm-hmm. and every boy in the orphanage is named after a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the boys needs to know what their martyr did and be able to recite.
That's right.
The way that person died defending mm-hmm. the homeland.
Mm-hmm. This is actually, you know, a lot of the things that seem unbelievable about North Korea are pretty factually based. This is one element that I invented because, you know, in North Korea, everyone must do 7 years of military service. Orphans, unfortunately, are a real problem in that society. There are a lot of people without anyone to care for them or advocate for them. In Korea as a whole, the idea of an orphanage is different. It's not really a place where you get adopted. It's more like a place where you're warehoused until you're an adult. And I did discover that the shame of having to put a child in an orphanage because you couldn't afford to care for him or her often led parents to keep the names of the children secret. And so that the family shame wasn't reflected back upon them. So the children would go in without names and have to be renamed. And I thought in North Korea, this is something that they would use. They use every opportunity to further the aim of the regime.
Right. And one of the things that happens to the boys that you describe in this mythical orphanage mm-hmm. is the adults coming in basically taking boys away for short periods or long periods of time mm-hmm. to do we do not know what.
Right. It's a source of child labor, which
right.
is, you know, thought to be a good use of, you know, that unfortunate outcome there. So, you know, the first few pages of the book kind of capture the 90s, the sense of the Soviets cutting off aid in the early 90s, the death of Kim Il-sung and the shock to that country in 94, the floods that came in 95, due in a large degree through deforestation, and the great famine that began, you know, in 96 that probably killed 10% of the population, which would be over 2 million. And, you know, just to get those couple pages right, to get the city of Chongjin, to get the industrial cannibalization going on, the fates of those people, was the product of, like I said, a couple years of research.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes across very strongly on the page. What's fascinating to me is that when the character Jeong-do, mm-hmm. is that how you say it?
Sure.
Or you say it for me.
I say Jeong-do.
Do, yeah. Okay. Do, like Play-Doh.
Oh, well, you know, pronunciation in Korean is not my expertise. If I'd have known I was going to spend 6 years writing a book set in Korea, the first thing I would have done is learn Korean. But that was a mistake of mine, I think.
So anyway, the next thing in Jeong-do's life is to be recruited as what would they refer to as a tunnel soldier.
That's right.
Which is another very, very interesting thing is these mm-hmm. miles and endless miles and miles and miles and miles of tunnels mm-hmm. under the entire country almost,
mm-hmm.
Where they literally do military exercises in the dark.
That's right. The North Koreans have prepared for the staging of a possible invasion of the South for decades. Six of these tunnels have been discovered so far. They're large tunnels, many kilometers long. They go deep underground into the sovereign territory of the ROK of South Korea. And the tunnels are all designed to be 10,000 men an hour, which is really moving a lot of vehicles, men and materiel into another country. So they're huge, they're long, and they have special crews who build these tunnels and maintain them and prepare to go to war through them.
And the tunnels are not straight. So
that's
that
right.
As you explained, if someone shoots a rocket or a bullet, mm-hmm. it'll hit a wall instead of, you know, continuing on for a long period
right.
of time.
Right. There's no line of sight.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Well, that certainly sets up the character for his next assignment, which is one of the most bizarre things I've ever heard, although I have read references to it in other sources about mm-hmm. the kidnappings of Japanese, usually at night.
That's right.
Off of beaches or lonely spots of land, mm-hmm. And very random at first,
mm-hmm.
but then much more specific. They are sent for a specific opera singer or a specific architect mm-hmm. or a specific cook.
Mm-hmm. This notion of the kidnappings is a bone of great contention between, you know, Japan and North Korea, because the North is so hermetically sealed, because they don't allow any cultural information about the outside world in, that when they want agents to travel abroad and act normally, they have to kidnap citizens of those places and try to learn proper, you know, native behavior. It's such a, you know, counterintuitive thing, but that's one of the side effects of being so closed off. In the 70s and 80s, there were many such kidnappings. The North Koreans have admitted to 34, though some estimates are over 100 people just from Japan were plucked from beaches, from piers, from islands, from their fishing boats by North Koreans who wanted language teachers, who wanted cultural intelligence, people to train their agents, you know, to move in a native way. And
so they could infiltrate into Japan?
So they could later infiltrate, walk amongst, gather information. The North Koreans are very paranoid about Japan, especially since there are so many people of Korean descent there that they think can be used against themselves.
Mm-hmm. why don't you read just this part of this this chapter here? It's a couple paragraphs, but it's as the kidnappings are coming to an end. And he's been doing it for how many years now, would you say?
Unknown.
Yeah.
Excuse me. There were many kidnappings to come, years of them, in fact. There was the old woman they came upon in a tidal pool in Shino Island. Her pants were rolled up, and she peered into a camera mounted on three wooden legs. Her hair was gray and wild, and she went without protest in exchange for Dundo's portrait. There was the Japanese climatologist they discovered on an iceberg in the Tsuguru Strait. They plucked his scientific equipment and red kayak too. There was a rice farmer, a jetty engineer, a woman who said she'd come down to the beach to drown herself. Then the kidnappings ended, as suddenly as they'd begun. Jundo was assigned to language school to spend a year learning English. He asked the control officer in Gyeongsung if the new post was a reward for stopping a minister's son from defecting. The officer took Jundo's old military uniform, his liquor ration card, and a coupon book for prostitutes. When the officer saw the book was nearly full, he smiled. "Sure," he said.
Mm-hmm. So we transition to his next occupation.
Yeah, I guess we get a lot of looks at this person's life. But, you know, orphans go into the worst assignments in the military. These portraits are all fairly accurate, if maybe an exaggeration to mash them all into the life of one character.
Right.
But I discovered so many fascinating real backdrops from North Korea. I wanted to give a reader a large sense of what that country was like, from life as an orphan, a soldier in the most remote places, to the lives of fishermen out on the sea who are notoriously conscripted to move counterfeit U.S. currency, heroin, rocket parts, to see how the military worked, the diplomats, and as we move closer to the capital, the elites, the military figures, the cultural figures. And finally, we meet the black hole that warps the gravity of North Korea, Kim Jong-il himself.
Right. I'm fascinated that you made him a character in your book. Yeah.
Well, you know, I wasn't going to at first because he's such a figure that has been blanked out in our culture.
Or lampooned.
As a figure of mockery.
Right.
And he does have his bouffant hair and his glasses and his elevator shoes, and he's brought that upon himself. But as a literary writer, you know, my job is to make characters whole, to give them weaknesses and strengths, to look inside them and to bring them to life as much as possible. And as I studied the culture and I delved deeper into the book, I realized that because the control over the population was total, and because one man managed that control, he alone was responsible for the fates, singularly, of everyone there. And that if we were to understand that place, we would have to meet the great scriptwriter himself.
Well, it's referred to often as the last Stalinist regime.
Hmm.
And one of the things that makes that work, and you mentioned that when, you know, he kind of the country made – this is Kim Jong-il's father – made, you know, approaches to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got distressed with where they were going and how they were acting. And so he created something called, you're going to have to say, is it Juche?
Juche.
Juche.
Juche was a national policy, a philosophy, if you will, espoused by Kim Il-sung, who's right. the founding leader of the DPRK. Juche translates roughly as rely on oneself. And it is this notion that
as a person and as a country.
That's right. That they should turn to no one for protection. They should allow no one to trample on themselves. And also that, you know, personally, should your government not be able to provide for you, that you would turn inward and find the inner substance to, you know, carry on and survive without, you know, looking for handouts. So it's also a philosophy that seems ready-made for people who are going to face deprivations.
Mm-hmm. Or who have to realize that they have a child they are unable to care for, as mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier.
That's right.
And then, you know, and shamefully mm-hmm. unable to care for.
When Kim Jong-il came to power, he couldn't refute his father's grand theory of Juche, and he pays homage to it. I speak about Kim Jong-il as if he's alive because my character seems alive, you know. But Kim Jong-il started a kind of a replacement policy called Sun Gun, which means military first. Hmm. And so while Juche is lip service is paid to that, really the notion of why people suffer there is has been replaced with an explanation that says we must be strong, our military must protect us, we must all sacrifice to feed them first. And Sun Gun rules the day there. The military get everything – and the people get very little.
Mm-hmm. Well, your character is a fascinating way to visit so many different parts of society and so many different activities that are going on. And I'm going to have we'll read about a few of them, you know,
sure.
share them with our listeners. One of them that happens is after he you know, does the kidnapping, and as you mentioned, he mm-hmm. goes to the English language school,
mm-hmm.
and he is taught by an African
mm-hmm.
who – does not speak Korean, mm-hmm. but has lots of interrogatories, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And so he learns that mode quite well.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't know what – you have no idea. There's a greater plan apparently for everybody in that country, or at least anyone who's on the radar. And the plan for this young individual was to put him on a fishing vessel,
mm-hmm.
but not as a fisherman. So can we read that little bit
here? I'd be happy to.
Okay. It's on page 40.
They're very proud of their language schools there. They fancy themselves as a very international society. In Pyongyang, when I visited, they showed me endless language labs that were actually very active, and we saw people learning all the languages of the world. They're very committed to translating the collected works of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung into every language on the planet. And the propaganda there that people have to believe is that the notions of the dear and great leader are adhered to by all the peoples of the planet. And therefore, you know, language is very important. And for such an insular place, I was really struck by the degree to which people could communicate in many different languages. So it might seem strange to us that a lowly character like Jun Do would go to language school. But in fact, it's quite common, and it is a reward for people who move up in the system.
Mm-hmm.
They're on a fishing vessel at this point.
Right.
They'd been in international waters for several days now, their North Korean flag lowered so as not to invite trouble. First, they'd chased deep-running mackerel and then schools of jittery bonito that surfaced in brief patches of sun. Now they were after sharks. All night the Junma had long lined for them at the edge of the trench, and at daybreak Jun Do could hear above him the grinding of the winch, and the slapping of the sharks as they cleared the water and struck the hull. From sunset to sunrise, Jun Do monitored the usual transmissions. Fishing captains mostly, the ferry from Uichi to Vladivostok, even the nightly check-in of two American women rowing around the world. One rode all night, the other all day, ruining the crew's theory that they'd made their way to the East Sea for the purpose of having girl sex. Hidden inside the Junma's rigging and booms was a strong array antenna, and above the helm was a directional antenna that could turn 360 degrees. The U.S. and Japan and South Korea all encrypted their military transmissions, which sounded only like squeals and bleats. But how much squeal and where and when seemed really important to Pyongyang. As long as he documented that, he could listen to whatever he liked. It was clear the crew didn't like having him aboard. He had an orphan's name, and all night he clacked away on his typewriter down there in the dark. It was as if having a person aboard whose job it was to perceive and record threats made the crew, young men from the port of Kinji, sniff the air for danger as well. And then there was the captain. He had reason to be wary, and each time Jun Do made him change course to track down an unusual sign, it was all he could do to contain his anger at the ill luck of having a listening officer posted to his fishing ship. Only when Jun Do started relating to the crew the updates of the two American girls rowing around the world did they begin to warm to him. When Jun Do had filled out his daily requisition of military soundings, he roamed the spectrum. The lepers sent out broadcasts, as did the blind, and the families of inmates imprisoned in Manila who broadcast news into the prisons. All day the families would line up to speak of report cards, baby teeth, and new job prospects. There was Dr. Rendezvous, a Brit who broadcast his erotic dreams every day, along with the coordinates of where his sailboat would be anchored next. There was a station in Okinawa that broadcast portraits of families that U.S. servicemen refused to claim. Once a day, the Chinese broadcast prisoner confessions, and it didn't matter that the confessions were forced, false, and in a language he didn't understand, Jun Do could barely make it through them. And then there came that girl who rode in the dark. Each night she paused to relay her coordinates, how her body was performing, and the atmospheric conditions. Often she noted things, the outlines of birds migrating at night, a whale shark seining for crew for krill off her bow. She had, she said, a growing ability to dream while she rode. What was it about English speakers that allowed them to talk into transmitters as if the sky were a diary? If Koreans spoke this way, maybe they'd make more sense to Jun Do. Maybe he'd understand why some people accepted their fates while others didn't. He might know why people sometimes scoured all the orphanages looking for one particular child when any child would do, when there were perfectly good children everywhere. He'd know why all the fishermen on the Junma had their wives' portraits tattooed on their chests, while he was a man who wore headphones in the dark of a fishhold on a boat that was 27 days at sea a month.
Amazing. I read that first part and I came across these, you know, the women rowers and the conversations that he catches glimpses of and the sharks, you know, carcasses whapping against the side of the ship and so much more detail. It's just so rich. And I began to wonder at that point, where did this come from? Mm-hmm. And is this going to be important? Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, of course, all those things are important.
That's right. You know, my mind is pretty good at Rubik's cubing plots together. And, you know, I try to not throw anything in there for, you know, just tour guiding around. The sharks are going to come back. The tattoos are going to come back. Those girl rowers you don't know are going to play an important role in the second half of the book. That all these little things, his relationship to the captain, we're going to see him again. They're all going to add up and hopefully fit together in a way that has a big effect.
It does. Mm-hmm. I'm going to credit you with having the book, not just for this year, but for last year as well, that I could not put down.
Oh, and that's wonderful to hear.
Tremendous, you know, I mean, for this show and personally too. Mm-hmm. And I was just captivated. Mm-hmm. I kept saying, oh my gosh, oh my God, oh, oh wow.
Yeah. Well, I do love a book that moves, that has momentum and inertia, that shows us new things, that has a sense of character in peril, who's trapped, he must make choices. And I love the feeling of when I read, letting go in confidence that a large consciousness is at work that's going to pull everything together. That's a joy to me. Mm-hmm. That sense of knowing there's an inevitability to things, even as it surprises you along the way. That's the twin joy of reading for me.
You are listening to Word by Word on KRCB 91.1 FM, where tonight's conversation is with the Stanford creative writing professor Adam Johnson about his captivating novel, The Orphan Master's Son, set in the clouded reality of North Korea. So stay tuned as Adam Johnson explains how he created his richly detailed novel right here on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org.
So as you put this together, did you have a chart on the wall or keep it in your head or what?
Actually, you know, as the book progresses, different voices enter. There's three voices. They're telling one objective story of our character Jundo and what happens to him. Then we meet a new voice in the second half of the book. He is an interrogator after Jundo's story is played out, who's trying to figure out exactly what happened. So he can write a biography. And finally, after he's done with his report, there's the state propaganda version that twists everything we've already seen to, you know, benefit the state. And the maybe confusing part at first of the second part of the book is that these three voices all go concurrently, even though they exist at different times. But as I read the testimonies of defectors, and I read lots and lots of them, people who'd made it out of North Korea.
Where did you find those?
Oh, there are lots of them online. We have actually a couple great sources of people who've made it out of gulags. The American State Department has a really wonderful website with lots of satellite maps, explanations of all the camps. And the South Koreans publish a ton of material. Mm-hmm. There's a facility in South Korea called Hanawon. And after people defect and make it to South Korea and to get out of North Korea is very difficult. You've got to cross the DMZ, which is almost impossible. So people go north through mountains. It's a mountainous country. They've got to get across the Yalu or the Tumen River, which at times is easy to cross if it's frozen or shallow. Other times it's quite dangerous. Once you're in southern China, you can easily become enslaved because China has a repatriation agreement with North Korea. Mm. And if a farmer discovers a young escapee on his property – you know, he knows that he could make one phone call and the authorities will take her back to be placed in prison. And so it's easy to become slave labor, to be exploited, to become a farmer's wife. To finally make it to the South, most people have to go all the way to Thailand, which has an agreement with the South. Last year, I think it's 2010, 6,344 people made it to the South. And in the north, people rarely defect from Pyongyang. If you live in the capital, you're one of the top few percent of the nation. You're not going to starve. You're going to have a decent government job, some modicum of electricity every day, some modern conveniences. But if you're from the provinces, meaning all the rest of the country, you might starve. You might face, you know, fewer commodities, less heating fuel, less timber, extra work, less medical care. Life there is much harder, and that's why people defect from those places. And when they come to Hanawon in South Korea, there's a little story that's taken of all of them based on interviews. Mm-hmm. And we have a large portrait of how much they eat, how much they work, what their lives are like, and the dangers they faced in escaping. It's Pyongyang that's the great mystery to us, because people don't defect there because life is good. We don't really –
or relatively good.
As far as they know, it's the best in the world. So that portrait is quite murky, and it used – I had to use fewer sources to draw a portrait of that place, and I had to use more imagination.
Hmm. Well, you describe one part in the second part of the book where there's this – quite lovely home on the top of a hill above Pyongyang. Mm-hmm. And it certainly seemed real to me.
Yes, that's Mount Taesong. It's just outside of Pyongyang on, you know, the the Taedong River, and it's a very sacred place to the Koreans. Here is where they have the Revolutionary Martyr Cemetery, a place of great honor. They have their zoo. They have like a fun park for children. They have plants there that are quite sacred called Kimjongilia and Kim Il-sungia, and that's where their hothouses are. And some of the high-ranking officials have homes at the top on Mount Jujak. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to get a look at every part of Pyongyang, you know, and this place with a view down into the valley, you know, allowed me to constantly regard the capital of that nation.
And what happens up there on top of that hill is all the sounds that come up, mm-hmm. the smells that come up.
That's right.
Right.
Yes.
That is a fascinating book. Let's continue on with our main character, though, because mm-hmm. we need to know what's going to happen to him next. He's on the ship, and he becomes a hero to the nation in the most unlikely way, because the ship is boarded. I'm going to kind of, you know, try to make this a little shorter, and you could fill in. But the ship is boarded by my American naval ship, mm-hmm. and in explored mm-hmm. for potential contraband or so whatever, and. As they're leaving, one of the officers hands his business card mm-hmm. to a member of the crew. And later on, one of the crew members, the second mate, takes the raft that's been left behind by the – because there's no lifeboats on this ship.
That's right. They're called escape boats there.
That's right. Well, exactly. Well, anyway, he uses that to escape somewhere, some unknown place. We assume heading south to mm-hmm. Korea. And so the crew has to come up with the story. So what story do they invent?
The idea of a different kind of storytelling was one of the things that drew me into the material of North Korea. In America, our stories are we all accept the notion that we're individuals. Our job is to find our best possible selves, to get in contact with our inner selves. In the stories we tell each other, and in the lives we lead, we're all the central characters in our own lives. Mm-hmm. We've got to discover our needs and yearnings. We need to move forward to attain those things and to become our better selves. We have to overcome obstacles and conflict. And in the end, we grow and change and discover. In North Korea, however, stories work differently. There's a national story. It's written by the regime. And it's approved by the Kims, and they're fine-tuning it through propaganda all the time. But in this story, there's one central character, Kim Jong-il in my book, Kim Jong-un now in The Nation, and everyone else in that country is a secondary character. They're given a role to play, and the defectors testify to the ways in which people come into the schools, give aptitude tests, and decide, oh, she's going to be an accordionist. He's going to become a fisherman. And your fates are set at an early age, and you're given a role. And in that world, your own thoughts and desires, your own needs and communications, revealing yourself, is all contrary to survival. It goes against playing this role properly, and you must play your role well to survive. So my character starts off as the perfect North Korean. He does what he's told, when he's told, even if it's ugly and grim. He even has chances to defect, and he doesn't take them. But as he meets Americans, as he listens to the broadcasts from other nations that I read in that excerpt, he begins to think there's a different way to live in this life, that you could become yourself, and that going on that search for inner meaning is important. And so really this book is about him going from North Korean character, which is probably quite foreign to a Western reader, to a character that we would recognize, who for love, for self-definition, who for freedom takes on a grand improvisational act to become the self he wants to be. And there's kind of a trial run, you know, when he meets the Americans and when one of his crew members defects, they have to try to find a story. An excuse for this that will fit within the role of North Koreans as being loyal, dedicated, and heroic. And that involves making a cover story that he was bit by a shark, killed by a shark, and our hero in his story, which depicts him attempting to rescue the guy, all they need is some evidence of a shark bite. And so it sounds really ludicrous, Gil, as I play it out now.
Well, it doesn't work. Read that way. But basically they winch one of the sharks up that's been caught earlier and latch it onto this man.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know –
I mean by his teeth.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's the scars that prove that, you know, that this man disappeared not through defection but through an attack, and that our character becomes declared a hero because of this act. It's a story that North Korea likes, that it uses. It becomes a propaganda story. He becomes paraded around. Our hero gets a medal, and that moves him into another realm where when a delegation of North Koreans travel to America to meet with a couple American diplomats, they bring this hero along.
Because he speaks English.
Because he speaks English. Because he's more worldly than most North Koreans, and because he has this story of heroism to boast of, and part of the heroic story is a shameful story about the Americans that they've concocted, and they want to use this story there. But it's about 100 or 125 pages in that our characters who are North Korean – who've been in their milieu in this strange context that the reader slowly orients to. They travel to America. And I remember writing these scenes, Gil, in which I had completely immersed myself in the North Korean perspective. And when I went to my own country, America, it seemed alien and foreign and strange.
Well, you go to Texas, which may be all those things.
Sure. We go to Texas and we see the Texan senator and his entourage try to be folksy, to put the North Koreans at ease, to make them comfortable, feel down homey. So they pick the North Koreans up from the airport in classic American cars, an old Thunderbird and a Mustang. And right away, the North Koreans are deeply insulted because a car of quality where they're from is a black Mercedes. They're shown how to cut brush and how to go fishing and shoot guns in a kind of little Texas sideshow. But even when they're given a barbecue in their honor, the idea that these men in suits from North Korea would sit outside in the sun like peasants at wooden picnic benches that were dirty, and that they would eat food with their hands in the presence of dogs, is the greatest insult that could ever be done to them. And the Americans can't see any of this, of course. And that my own country seemed foreign gave me great faith that maybe I was pulling the book off. It gave me a lot of energy to move forward.
Well, at the same time, the Koreans are playing the Americans.
That's right, yes.
Because they have a cooler with them. Mm-hmm. With a piece of tiger's meat in it,
yes,
which they offer as a great delicacy and say, why don't you cook this and serve it?
That's right. This is something in my research I found an episode of the junta in Burma giving a gift to Kim Jong-il. It was in one of the propaganda announcements of tiger meat, you know, which to the rest of the world is really shocking that this endangered species would be eaten and would be a sign of, I don't know, respect.
Virility or something?
Something.
Yeah.
But it horrifying to us, but obviously it happens over there. So the North Koreans try to put the Americans off balance. They know that the Americans are going to be horrified to receive a gift of tiger meat. So they really just bring some flank steak and tell them it's tiger and, you know, give the Americans moral high ground to begin the negotiations.
Right. Well, the experience in Texas is quite amazing. When he goes home, he's debriefed, I guess you would call it, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the things he talks about is those things you've mentioned about having forced to eat outside and ride in ancient cars and shoot weapons that may blow up as you use them and sleep with dogs.
Sleep with dogs.
So tell me about dogs in North Korea.
Well, there are, of course, dogs in North Korea. They're illegal in the capital. The capital is a show place. Everyone's relatively handsome, relatively young in general. I saw no handicapped people there in any way. If you have something that's perceived as, you know, a flaw or a defect there, you're sent to live other places. And I asked our minders where the handicapped people were, and our head minder feigned to not know what I was talking about. But if you're in the capital, it's a place of beautiful, successful people. And so they keep it free of dogs so that it doesn't look rural and provincial. There are 6 dogs in Pyongyang. They were the gift from the king of Swaziland to Kim mm-hmm. Jong-il. Mm-hmm. And they live in the Central Zoo, which I did not visit, but I'm told is a pretty grim place. And supposedly they're fed a diet of soft tomatoes and cabbage mm-hmm. to lessen their aggressive nature. Now, when I was out in the countryside near the Mioyang Mountains, I saw dogs. I saw strays roaming the streets of, you know, Kaesong, you know, in the south. I read reports of in other places in North Korea, there are 2 kinds of dogs. So dogs that are like pets and watchdogs and family animals. And they have a special breed that they, you know, breed for consumption, mm-hmm. you know, for protein.
Right. Well, there's a real problem when they come back from Texas because a dog comes along too as a special gift from the senator to the great leader.
That's right. They do bring a puppy back to North Korea, which I didn't know that would turn out to be a kind of nice plot device that I could use later. That dog makes a wonderful, wonderful late appearance in the book. But, you know, the truth is that people who have too much exposure to the outside world in North Korea can be seen as being tainted. And there's a notion there of sungbun, not songun, which I mentioned earlier, but mm-hmm. sungbun. And this is a kind of a rating or a concept of how loyal you are and your family and how revolutionary your spirit is. And there are a lot of examples of people who've just been exposed to too much foreign culture. They become a threat to the state in that they might pass on news or word or portraits of the outside world and get other people riled up about you know, the truth behind the propaganda they hear. And a lot of people go into the gulags, like the North Korean soccer team famously all went into the gulag, even though they'd tried their best.
At the Olympics.
It was like a European World Cup, okay. And they'd lost. They'd also supposedly gotten drunk afterwards and behaved badly, so no one knows exactly what. But they'd been made soccer players by the state. Mm-hmm. They'd performed to the best of their ability, and they all went into the gulag.
Well, the part in the gulag is probably the most shudder causing, mm-hmm. is that a way to call it?
Sure.
Part of the book. I know there are other, you know, famous books about gulags mm-hmm. and in different parts of the world. But there's one section here where Jeondo gets introduced to the place. So if you could mm-hmm. read, there's a little bit about a page here,
sure.
and you understand why I want you to. And I will warn our listeners that this is a little grim.
I read a lot about, you know, gulag narratives, the Quanli So system as they're called there. And they're really very sinister places. If you're deemed irredeemable, you don't get a sentence or a trial. You don't ever come out. You're worked to death. And there are several prisons like that. You know, I really couldn't put much of that material in this book because it was just too overpowering probably. But there are moments in which I feel a duty to give a portrait to the reader of some of the grim realities of this place. Here he's being introduced to the prison he's going to go. Jeondo took a crate and met the medic at the bedside of a woman who had her jaw tied shut with strips of cloth that circled her head. One medic began unlacing her shoes, which were just rotten tire treads wrapped with wire. The other began unwrapping tubing and intravenous lines, all precious medical supplies. Jeondo touched the woman's skin, which was cool. "I think we're too late," he told them. The medics ignored them. They ran each line into a vein on the tops of her feet, then attached two empty blood bags. The old photographer appeared with her camera. She called to the guard for the woman's name, and when he told her, the photographer wrote it on a gray slate and placed it on the woman's chest. Then the photographer unwound the strips of cloth from the woman's hand. When the photographer removed the woman's cap, most of her hair came off with it, lining it with a black swirl. "Here," she said, slipping the cap into Jun Doe's hand. "Take it." The cap looked heavy with ground-in grease. Jun Doe hesitated. "Don't you know who I am?" the old photographer asked. "I'm Meng Nan. I take the pictures of all who arrive and depart from this place." She shook the cap insistently. "It's wool. You'll need it." Jun Doe pocketed the cap as a way to shut her up, to stop her and her crazy talk. When Meng Nan took the woman's picture, the flash awakened her for a moment. She reached from the cot to Jun Doe's wrist and clenched it. In her eyes was a very clear desire to take him with her. The medics yelled at Jun Doe to lift the head of the cot. When he did so, they kicked the crate underneath, and soon the four blood bags were filling nicely. Jun Doe said to the medics, "We better work fast. It's getting dark, and the driver said he doesn't have headlights." The medics ignored him. The next person was a teenager, his chest cool and pale blue. His eyes were drawn so that they turned with labor in increments. One of his arms hung off the cot, outstretched to the rough-hewn floorboards. "What's your name?" Meng Nan asked him. His mouth kept making a motion as though he was trying to wet his lips before speaking, but the words never came. Soft and tender, with the voice of a mother, she whispered to the dying boy. "Close your eyes," she said. And when he did, she snapped a photo. The medics used the strips of medical tape to secure the bloodlines, and the process repeated itself. Jun Doe lifted the cot and slid the next crate under it, and the boy's head gently lolled, and then Jun Doe was carrying the warm bags to the cooler. The life of the boy, the true life of him, had literally drained warm into these bags that Jun Doe held, and it was like the boy was still alive in the bags until Jun Doe personally snuffed him by dropping them into the ice water. For some reason, he expected the warm bags of blood to float, but they sank to the bottom.
There's something about reading about, you know, how they were catching sharks and cutting off the fins and selling them to the Chinese, which is reprehensible as it is. But when you read this part and you realize that they're dealing in human blood and body parts in international trafficking, and that's not the only thing that North Korea does that is, you know, outside of what I guess we would with our Western eyes think was legitimate.
Right, right. Well, like I say, reading of the amputations, of forced abortions, of the things that take place in these camps, the starvation, the executions, it was very difficult going. There's a book coming out that I'll plug next month from Viking, and it's the story of Shin Dong-hook. It's one of the grimmer stories you'll ever read concerning humanity that you could imagine. It's written by a Washington Post reporter named Blaine Harden, and it's the story of Shin, who was born in a camp, Camp 1418. The camp straddles the Taedong River. 18 is a lighter camp. It's a place where you'll eventually get out. You could be redeemable if you worked hard enough and long enough. You could be returned to society. But if you go across the river to Camp 14, those are the irredeemables. It's there that everyone is going to work until they die. Shin's father was kind of a trustee, which means he collaborated with the guards and helped the guards. And as a reward, he was given a wife and the ability to have children, one of the rarest instances ever of this in, you know, a Kwan Lee So camp. And Shin and his brother grew up. And I think in America, we're drawn to Sophie's Choice-like stories sometimes in our movies, in our literature, in our news stories. Impossible decisions that human beings have to face, I think, evoke in us an inner questioning about what we would do with an impossible situation. But I feel that North Koreans, based on my research, all at some point in their lives must face an impossible decision to report someone else, to be denounced or to denounce, to choose between a child who can eat and a child who can't, to have to face a forced marriage or et cetera.
Right.
And, you know, in this camp, Shin was 14 and he was weak and hungry, and his parents decided to escape with his brother, who was older, and they thought he was just a liability, that he just couldn't keep up with them, so they left without him. And they didn't make it. And Shin saw them captured and returned, and he was forced to bear witness in their executions. Often everyone in a camp must participate in an execution, even if in a symbolic way. And he lived there another 10 years. He was tortured and burned before he eventually escaped. And in a Quan Li So camp, there's no indoctrination. No one tells you who Kim Jong-il is or Kim Il-sung. They don't teach you Juche theory or Songun theory because you're disposable and you're never going to get out. And you're controlled through physical means instead of psychological means. So he managed to escape. He didn't know he was wearing a haircut that marked him his whole life as a prisoner.
Mm.
He was really in Plato's allegory of the cave, where survival was everything and no one had anything to live for, and that he managed to get out of Camp 14, then out of North Korea, then out of China, and to give us the rarest portrait of deprivation on Earth is a feat that no one else has managed to do. And it's these human stories that I felt I had to capture to some degree in the book.
Well, you've done a marvelous job with it. It's essentially two books, wouldn't you say? Mm. Or at least you divide it into two books. But, of course, what we find out is the person in the second book has a very strong connection.
Sure.
Is a good way to put it?
No spoilers.
With the first book. And we find out parts of the first person's history in the second book because under the interrogation techniques. Mm-hmm. It is a fascinatingly it's like – I know you write science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like another science fiction world, but it's on this planet today.
That's right. No need to invent it.
No. Hmm. Well, I want to thank you extremely much for coming and sharing your time with us. Adam, you have anything to say to our listeners who are wannabe writers or are writers?
Hmm. Well, I think it's I think it's a worthwhile calling. I think telling stories is really important. I think when people leave North Korea, they have to learn to tell their stories. They've been taught their whole lives not to have an individual voice. And we live in a land with art and with books where we can decide to be artists and we can tell stories that matter. I also, teach my students that that the odds that you're going to be a great storyteller and that you're going to have a great story to tell are rare. And a lot of great storytellers don't climb Mount Everest or change the world. But when we meet people who do have stories that matter, who cannot for whatever reason tell their own, often because they're traumatized, that you maybe have a duty to help other people get important stories into the world. And I felt that obligation a great deal in this book.
Again, this is Adam Johnson. Thank you for The Orphan Master's Son.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to Word by Word on KRCB 91.1 FM, where tonight's fascinating conversation was with the Stanford Creative Writing Professor Adam Johnson about his captivating novel The Orphan Master's Son, set in the clouded reality of North Korea. The studio engineer for tonight's show is Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We invite you to tune into Word by Word from 7 to 8 p.m. on May 2nd, the first Wednesday of the month, for our next Conversation with Writers show, right here on KRCB 91.1 FM or streaming online at krcb.org. Until then, enjoy your springtime celebrations with your family and friends.